We are in a revolution, a cultural revolution, a soft revolution to be sure. Not all revolutions come with tanks and guns, not initially anyway. But we must remember what Chairman Mao said, a revolution is not a dinner party. This is not viewpoint diversity. This is a monopoly on ideology. That's not the best education, and especially when the ideology is subversive to America and especially to the Christian faith. We need to be able to show that Christianity is good for the world, that it's reasonable and that it's true. This is the field of Christian thought, of Christian apologetics. But if we do not reclaim the universities, if you do not change the university, you're just putting chlorine downstream and it's only going to be clean for 15 seconds.
Welcome. I'm going to introduce our speaker today. So our speaker is Corey Miller. He's the author of The Progressive Miseducation of America. And we have several of these copies just over here in the corner. So after the time, you can go there and just use the QR code and you can pay for this. And if you want Corey to sign this, just after this is over, he'll hang out and he'll sign these for you if you like. And the subtitle is Confronting the Cultural Revolution from the Classroom to Your Community. And in the book, Corey says, we have a choice to make and it must be soon. And he points his finger predominantly at higher education. And it's actually, I'm in higher education and it is scorched earth for higher education. And that's what Corey does. He says, losing the American universities to post-Christian secularism is one of the greatest debacles and tragedies of world history. Background on Corey, he grew up in Utah as a seventh generation Mormon. He came to Christ and later became a pastor, philosophy professor, campus minister, and now he serves as president and CEO of Ratio Christi, which is on many campuses around here. Rice has a chapter of Ratio Christi. It's more of an apologetics type ministry, working with young people, teaching them how to give an answer to the questions that confront us. He has authored or edited 5 books, and he holds 3 master's degrees, along with a PhD from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. His thought is centered on the intersection of faith, reason, and culture. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Corey. And then after Corey speaks for a while, then he and I are going to have a dialogue where I'll ask him questions. And then after that, we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. And with that, Corey, take it away.
Thank you, Jim. So as he mentioned, my background was Mormonism, seventh generation. My ancestor was one of Joseph Smith's bodyguards. My family likes to say that we come from healthy stock because he had 5 wives and 36 children, of which I'm a descendant. So I've written a couple of books on that. I've written a couple of books on philosophy. But my most important book, I think, ever is the current book, and that is the one that we're going to be talking about today. A small glimpse in this, The Third Revolution and the Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. Approximately 30 years ago this month, Mark Knoll, the historian, wrote the book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And that was to say that there isn't much of an evangelical mind. That's not consistent with the history of Christianity for the previous 1900 years. But in the last century, we abdicated our role and responsibility in high culture, pulling out of the universities, creating a vacuum, and it got assumed by other people, other ideas, and that has come to rock our world even inside of the churches. We are in a revolution, a cultural revolution, a soft revolution to be sure. Not all revolutions come with tanks and guns, not initially anyway, but we must remember what Chairman Mao said, a revolution is not a dinner party. Perhaps you like The Lord of the Rings and you remember the opening scene by the elven prince Galadriel, who said, "The world has changed. I feel it in the water. I feel it in the earth. I smell it in the air. Much that once was is lost, for none now live who remember it. Several years ago, 2019, I befriended a man named Peter Boghossian. Boghossian is one of the new atheists, as they were once called in the first part of this century. He said, your new role is that of the interventionist, liberator. Your target is faith. Your pro bono clients are individuals who have been infected by faith. He wrote the book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, forward by the Skeptic magazine editor, Michael Shermer, endorsed by Richard Dawkins. Boghossian and I connected because we both saw something on the horizon that we both thought was worse than each other. He was a liberal atheist, I was a conservative Christian, and somehow we were seeing an alliance forging. He invited me to come to Portland State University, where he was teaching an atheism seminar, a 300-level course, to give arguments for God's existence. And then, of course, as he likes to do, he trained his students to try to take me down. So it was a good time for all. Then we went out to lunch after, and he shared with me this proposal. He wanted an alliance. He said, if you go, we go. And by we, he meant in context, Dawkins, Harris, Dennett, Hitchens, and so forth. He goes, you guys are already out. They're coming next for me. And no one wants to hear about talking snakes anyway. So stop talking about apologetics. If you want me to talk to your board, I'll talk to your board. We need an alliance. I'm done with this atheism-theism debate. I'm dedicating the rest of my career to defeating social justice and critical theory because this is about civilization. Shortly after that, he wrote an article for The American Mind. Welcome to Culture War 2.0, the Great Realignment. He's talking about these new alliances that he was envisioning forging, and I was seeing the same kind of thing. His view of Culture War 1.0 was their victory with Obergefell and gay marriage. He says now, 2.0, we need a new alignment, new allies. When Churchill and Stalin looked at each other, they weren't buddies. But in order to defeat the little mustache guy, Adolf Hitler, they had to come together. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And we knew that we were on polar opposite ends when it came to God's existence. But there was something else out there that was even more threatening. I learned about this stuff at seminary, didn't think a thing of it, got to Purdue University in my doctoral program in philosophy, taking a course on Marxism from a distinguished professor of philosophy, himself a Marxist, and I saw what was happening in the classroom, and I saw something is coming down the pipeline. Some of my peers, one got kicked out of the department for burglary, another has in recent years been investigated by the Texas Attorney General. I've had a congressman from this state contact me to do a character assessment. He doxed a police chief's wife. He's written 4 books on anarchy. He's an Antifa professor tenured here in Texas, or at least was. Boghossian and I started out on a speaking tour together. We decided we'd start in the state of Utah, covered 4 universities in 2 days. A Christian and atheist unite against the death of intellectual diversity at the university. How social justice and identity politics are negatively impacting culture and the university. We began at Utah State University. That is where the alleged assassin of Charlie Kirk took his first semester of college. There we had one student group try to cancel us, writing an open letter to the president that we were logical fascists, code word for racists, simply because we were talking about viewpoint diversity in the universities. We went through a couple of other universities. We got to the University of Utah, and even one of the Christian campus ministries that I used to be part of said that they were going to come, were fearful of coming. And I said, why? We're just talking about viewpoint diversity. If there's any kind of diversity that ought to be prized in the universities above pigment and body parts, it's sharing ideas, the competition of the free exchange of ideas. He was afraid. He said he would come, and instead he forced his staff to watch a video on white guilt. So that ministry never came, and I contacted the president after. I tried to contact the atheist groups to come, and Peter Boghossian told me, I can't do it. They're not going to help me. They wouldn't lift a hand. All of the atheist groups on campus have gone woke. They're not like Richard Dawkins and Peter Boghossian and Game anymore. They have had a change of mind as well. We ended at Utah Valley University. That's where this picture is taken, where Charlie Kirk was assassinated. He was trying to do free speech and dialogue, and they killed the man who was engaging in peaceful dialogue. Fast forward several years, Peter hated Trump. Whether you like Trump or hate Trump, Peter hated Trump. I'm inclined to think he voted for him in this last election. A lot has changed. He said on Twitter just before the election, so many centrists and liberals have whispered the unthinkable to me. They'll be voting for Trump. You see this radical changing happening in our culture. You see, for example, at politics. And remember, politics is downstream from culture. Culture is downstream from education. And the apex of education is the university. So what you're seeing down there, downstream, has come from up there. That's the causal nexus of the whole thing. And in our politics, in our body politic today, you see this strange thing. You see recent Democratic presidential candidates like Tulsi Gabbard and RFK, a Kennedy, now Republicans. You see a lifelong Democrat, Elon Musk, now calling himself even a cultural Christian. Jordan Peterson calls himself an existentialist Christian, whatever that means. He's right at the gate knocking, right? You have Bruce Jenner, AKA Caitlyn Jenner, who ran for the Republican nomination for governor of California. It's like, what in the world is going on? There's some strange bedfellows, some strange new alliances. That's because we are in a cultural revolution, and that is simply downstream from what is happening upstream. And it's why Boghossian's buddy, who wrote the grievance studies, if you remember that, this happened right around the time that I made friends with Peter Boghossian. James Lindsay, Helen Pluckrose, and Peter Boghossian all submitted about 21 peer-reviewed journal articles to journals that are in very leftist areas. Definitely not liberal, but leftist. There is a distinction there. And those articles were like looking at rape culture by examining dog private parts in Portland, Oregon, or a rewrite of Hitler's Mein Kampf using feminist language over the top of it, but really just having it Hitler's Mein Kampf and other ridiculous articles that were all fabricated. And only until a Wall Street Journal person spotted it did they realize these things were a hoax. They had almost half of them accepted for publication. One received an award, and many others were ready for acceptance. They made it all up to show that this is not scholarship. This is activism. And so you're seeing a split right then between a liberal atheist and the new left, the Marxist left that we'll get into. Culture. Remember, politics is downstream from culture. Our entire culture is being upended. People feel it on the left. They feel it on the right. Everybody is feeling it. Culture is what is defined by the norms, the values, the practices, customs, beliefs, language, laws, and shared meanings. In every one of those categories, things are being challenged and upended right now. Looking back over 25 years, we can see when the question emerged, Americans said that patriotism was very important. That was the end of last century, the end of last millennium. This is a new century, a new millennium. 25 years in the making. 70% said yes when you sing the Lee Greenwood song, Proud to Be an American. Now you really put your hand on your heart, perhaps. You look around and you wonder. Half of the people hate the country, the other half hate what it's become, and everyone wonders if they're proud to be an American. Because that statistic has now dropped virtually in half, down to 39%, whatever. Those who say religion is very important, we know that that's been taking a dive. 62%, then down to 39%. What about raising children? Isn't that something we all, that's part of the American dream? picket fence, have children, forget the picket fence, have children, get married, have a family. Isn't that something that we think of as being centrally important? 59%, now down to less than one third are concerned about raising children. And that's why the birth rate replacement is 2.1 for a society. We're at 1.6. In three generations, America will be 50% of its current population. That is an interesting statistic to consider. And then looking back just 5 years, one of the last living virtues in America, often associated with liberalism, tolerance, is at 58%, down from just 5 years ago at 80%. If this is what has happened in the last 5 years or 25 years, what will the next 5 and 25 years look like? A few years back, David Kinnaman, Gabe Lyons wrote a book called Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. 44% believe that people of faith are part of the problem and could hardly be part of the solution. Only 20%, 1 in 5, trust clergy. These guys used to be the most trustworthy people, perceived as the most trustworthy, and the brightest intellects in the culture. Public perception has shifted, though. Instead of thoughtful pastors in mind and heart, they're now empty minds. They're irrelevant. They have nothing to offer society. And on a bad day, they're viewed as pedophile priests. 40% of American adults think that proselytizing, that is sharing your faith, is extremist. We used to call it extremist when they would bomb the World Trade Centers. But now it's just proselytizing. But somehow it magically goes up by 20 points, 60% when Christians proselytize. I guess the good news is that 50% of our population thinks that the church is still relevant when it comes to food pantries and keeping the kids off streets. But once you tell them why you're providing for the food pantries and keeping the kids off streets, now it's a problem. Shut up. Just give me your kids and give us your tuition. For the last several years, Arizona Christian University has been pulling out a biblical worldview inventory, trying to figure out how many Americans still hold to a biblical worldview. And some of the figures that go into that are simply things like, well, you believe God exists. Humans are sinners. They need a savior. Jesus is the only way. The Bible is God's word. It's historically reliable in all it affirms. Truth exists. It's grounded in God. The purpose of life is to know, love, and serve God. And success is understood through faithful obedience to God. Seems pretty commonsensical to be a biblical Christian. You hold a biblical worldview. In 2022, that was down to 6%. That means at least one of those wasn't believed. A year later, it's down to 4%. For pastors, just above a third. Among evangelical and non-denominational pastors, the good news is it's just above half. We're in trouble. And if the pastors are in this condition, and they're the ones supposed to be equipping the flocks, far too much engagement in skinny jeans and fog machines and doing whatever they're doing, coming in from sociology and culture rather than giving it out through theology and scripture. Our kids, our parents, who are supposed to be equipping primarily their own children to send them off to what I've called now the secular baptismal fonts, we're in a world of hurt, because let's look at what's going to happen once they get there. In the mid-90s, liberal to conservative ratios of professors was 2.3 to 1. That's still severe. If you get 100 professors in the room, that's severe, but you've got checks and balances. You've got accountability. No one can just get away with saying anything or writing anything they want. There's no blasphemy laws, no attending punishments for violating some of these sacred cows. But now, 2020, the year when everything broke loose, right? That was the year of COVID. That's the year that George Floyd died. And that time, age 60 and above, those for retirement age, 12 to 1. And those 40 and under who got tenure and have decades ahead of them, 23 to 1. In New England, if you want to send your kids to the Ivy Leagues, 27 to 1. And every time I show these stats, a mom or a dad says, we need to make sure our son Charlie needs to attend a religious studies class. I say, no, that's the worst. It's 70 to 1 there. That's where Bart Ehrman is at UNC. In 2023, political donations by Yale faculty went to Democrats almost 100%. Yale political diversity among the social sciences and humanities, the ratio of left to right, is 78 to 1. This is not viewpoint diversity. This is a monopoly on ideology. That's not the best education, and especially when the ideology is subversive to America and especially to the Christian faith.
If you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, send me an email, tour@drjamestour.org, and we will get together and I will share with you about why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus.
You can look at statistics that show the various Ivy League schools proportioned out by blue Democrats, red Republicans. And again, this is not about politics. Again, that's downstream. But as you know, a Democrat and secularist and liberal or progressive or Marxist, those are not the same. But there's a Venn diagram with a lot of shared space. Likewise, Republican and conservative and Christian, those are not the same. But there's a Venn diagram with a lot of shared space. Most Bible-believing Christians do vote a particular way. Most atheists vote a particular way. And again, there are exceptions. But this is severe. This is not equal in the least bit. And now let's talk about students, because now the professors are even scared of students. They created this by training K through 12s who went into the system, and now they're getting even elementary school kids into middle school, transing and then going into high school and getting into the professor's classroom and demanding their rights. Half of the students on campus, according to a national Yale survey, and this was 8 years ago, support campus speech codes. That means there are lexicons of thou shalt not words you should not use. 81% believe that words are a form of violence. Not violence is violence, but words are violence. This is why Charlie had to die. He said bad things like transgenderism is not real. It's in the mind. There are no women trapped in men's bodies and vice versa. And for that, he had to die. He was erasing their existence. He was murdering them. One third of all students believe that physical violence is justified to prevent hate speech. Well, we're in a culture of assassination today, is what the New York Post described it back in April, where 56% of those, according to a Rutgers survey, if they identified on the left, 56% said that it was justifiable to assassinate President Trump. 50% said assassinate Elon Musk. This is a new world. Two-thirds of all students say that hate speech is anything a student believes to be considered hurtful to a particular person. You hurt me. You erased my existence. You need to die. Take one for the team. It's gotten so bad that you even have people now looking who are not Christians. Tom Holland calls himself an agnostic Christian, if that is a thing, right? He's right at the door. He's knocking, sort of like Jordan Peterson. He said that every human being possessed an equal dignity was not remotely self-evident to truth. The Romans would have laughed at it. The origins of this principle, as Nietzsche had so contemptuously pointed out, lay not in the French Revolution, nor in the Declaration of Independence, nor in the Enlightenment, but in the Bible, in his book Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Made the World. He is a Roman and Greek scholar, historian. He goes on to say in another article why I was wrong about Christianity. The founding conviction of the Enlightenment, that it owed nothing to the faith into which its greatest figures had been increasingly, had been born increasingly, came to seem to me unsustainable. Even as belief in God fades across the West, the countries that were once collectively known as Christendom continue to bear the stamp of the 2-millennia-old revolution that Christianity represents. It is why we generally assume that every human life is of equal value. In my morals and ethics, I have learned to accept that I am not Greek or Roman, but thoroughly and proudly Christian. Wow. Agnostic Christian, right? Even Richard Dawkins, the Ivant Terrible of atheism, the Robespierre of the French Revolution, who tried to guillotine the traditional priestcraft and religious believers, got guillotined by his own guillotine. And Peter Boghossian once said to me, in a paraphrase, I told Richard, if he's not careful, he's only going to be allowed to speak on Ratio Christi campuses going forward. Dawkins said in his most recent book, Outgrowing God, A Beginner's Guide, whether irrational or not, I won't try my British accent, whether irrational or not, it does unfortunately seem plausible that if somebody sincerely believes God is watching his every move, he might be more likely to be good. In other words, he's admitting that Christian culture is good, that Christians can be good. In fact, they can be a kind of better good than non-Christians because they have this divine spy camera theory, as he calls it. People are watching their every move. And so now he wants to call himself a cultural Christian. I'm sorry, friends. Let's be friends. I'm sorry I tried to burn down your homes, but can we be friends again? Right? He loves the fruit of Christendom. He loves the church bells, he says. When it comes to Islamism or Marxism, he says he's on Team Christian every time. He loves those beautiful apples. He thinks he can get them in the supermarket all the time, indefinitely. But he can't. You can't have the fruit without the root. And that's where we come in during this cultural revolution, when people are finally starting to see at a macro level what culture might look like if we actually get rid of what built Western civilization in the first place. Dawkins, poor Dawkins. If you remember Rachel Dolezal, she wasn't, a man pretending to be trapped in a woman's body. She claimed to be a white or black person trapped in a white person's body. And she's not alone. There are many others, but she was the test case. Dawkins tweeted, Rachel Dolezal, a white chapter president of NAACP, was vilified for identifying as black. Some men choose to identify as women, and some women choose to identify as men. You will be vilified if you deny that they literally are what they identify as. Discuss. And, of course, her parents outed her on social media by showing all of her white girl pictures growing up, and she doubled down and continued to self-identify. But Dawkins got the Humanist of the Year award stripped from him by the American Humanist Association that they had given him 25 years before. Dawkins is not the same as the new left. He is part of the liberal left, the atheist left perhaps, but there is a new sheriff in town in the universities. We are in a position where Nietzsche sort of dreamed of in The Madman. Nietzsche said, a madman who arose early in the morning with a lantern in hand, shouting, "Where is God?" But because no one in the town square believed, they laughed and jeered. Is God lost? Is he hiding? Then one said, "We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. Is there any up or down left? Do we not hear anything yet of those who have killed him? How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves?" In other words, how are we going to move forward now that God is dead? You can't have the fruit without the root. If you don't believe in a sanctifier of human life, there is no such entailment of the sanctity of human life. And this is where philosophers like Peter Singer at Princeton, the most famous moral philosopher alive, writes the book, The Unsanctifying of Human Life. What are we going to do now that we no longer have that fundamental moral principle? And what explains this massive cultural shift? Well, ask the question, what is the number one institution upstream shaping culture downstream? We better get ready for this. We can't keep putting chlorine downstream in politics and thinking that is going to change things. It'll clean the water for 15 seconds, and then it's going to be dirty again because it's coming from a different direction. The university. That explains the Cultural Revolution. As go the universities, so goes the culture. As go the U.S. universities, so goes the world. One in three world leaders, prime ministers, presidents, dictators, all earned an academic degree from a U.S. university. This is the change point in human civilization right now. The universities. We go back and do the history as I've done in my book, and I've been to all of the colonial schools as well, examined the etchings in their buildings that are still there. Harvard, 1636, right after the Pilgrims, the Puritans landed, got stuffed on their turkey for Thanksgiving. They went and started Harvard, whose motto was Veritas, Latin for truth, quickly changed it to a sentence that lasted nearly 300 years, truth for Christ and the church, until 1936. As Harvard started drifting left, Yale started. Some of the professors went over there, some businessmen innovated, and their motto was Lux et Veritas, light and truth, quoting a psalm. And then you have Princeton, one of the great graduates from Yale was Jonathan Edwards, famous metaphysician and theologian. He became a president at Princeton, De Subnumine Viget, under God she flourishes. And then Columbia University, by thy light we shall see light, on and on and on. For 200 years, up until 1840, every college had a president who was also a member of the clergy, and that's why I said the clergy have fallen on hard times. They were the smartest cats in the neighborhood. They taught the capstone course of the senior students in moral philosophy before they graduated them and sent them out into the world. And until 1880, church and chapel attendance were still required. But something happened. Something happened, and as Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, says, we have two ears and one mouth for a reason, so that we listen more. So let us listen. How did we lose the universities? Because in that, there is a clue on how we can reclaim the intellectual voice of Christ in the universities. I speak of three revolutions. Three revolutions. The first one, scientific naturalism. Between 1808 and 1930, there's more complexity to this than I will share here. Get my book and you'll see all the details. But we had no PhD programs in the United States. So we sent our best and brightest overseas to mostly to the most educated country in the history of the world, formally speaking, and that was Germany. And that's where, in the same century, you had Immanuel Kant, whose philosophy we remember by "You can't know ultimate reality." The Enlightenment began with skepticism, Descartes, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, and it ended with Kant's agnosticism, who then started infecting and impacting everything, to Schleiermacher, the father of modern liberal theology, and Hegel, and Freud and his sexuality, and Nietzsche and God is dead, and Marx and Engels, and so many more, and biblical higher criticism. They all came back with their nice PhDs. The only ones having PhDs back in the States, and the battle was on, and we lost Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, and everything else, and we had to start all over with new schools, with no technology, and $100 in the savings account, trying to catch up with where we left off. And right at the end of the 1930s, when the dust was still settling, something more nefarious was beginning to take shape once again in Germany. Someone has said, does anything good happen in Galilee? Has anything good happened in Germany since the Reformation? Something nefarious taking place in Germany again, this little town called Frankfurt, the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, critical race theory, critical gender theory, critical pedagogy, critical queer theory, and so on. These guys were Jewish, they were neo-Marxist, they were blending Freud's sexuality with classical Marxism, spreading the categories from just class to now race, class, sex, gender, ethnicity, nationality, ability, and so forth. Everybody is a have and a have-not, a victim and a victimizer, an oppressor and an oppressed class. Whether you think you are or not, you are. That's how the world is divided up. And they were socialists, Jewish socialists, and there were other socialists there, little mustache guy, Adolf Hitler, who liked borders. They didn't like borders. They were Antifa, anti-fascist. The other guys liked borders, and they liked blonde hair and blue eyes as well. So they had some differences. Hitler rose to power in 1933. They had to get out of there, and they went to Harvard, Columbia, Brandeis, UCLA, and began teaching. Down south, Antonio Gramsci, imprisoned by Mussolini, who was a communist. Now he was a fascist. The commies and the Nazis, not terribly different, but they imprisoned Antonio Gramsci, who is considered by some to be the most dangerous of cultural Marxists. He never got out of prison, but his prison notes got mediated into the English-speaking world in my state of Indiana at Notre Dame University of all places by a Marxist professor named Joseph Buttigieg, father of Mayor Pete. And then about 15 years later, we see the launch of postmodernism, Foucault, Derrida, deconstruction, and Lyotard and others. Each one of them to the first and second generation. Not quite relativists like you think of when you think postmodernism, because they were all part of the new left, uber leftists politically for the first and second generations. Turns out they were all members of the French Communist Party or sympathizers of it. So you have this new left all traveling over to America, getting into our top universities. And the second revolution is the postmodern amalgam with cultural Marxism. And that's what we're experiencing right now. And the third revolution is, wait for it, pause, really quick, a book by Barna, Reviving Evangelism, Current Realities That Demand a New Vision for Sharing Your Faith. The question was asked, what increases interest in Christianity for you? And 44% of them, they had 13 questions to answer, 44% of them said, better evidence to support it. Turns out the non-believers want evidence. And yet this option was picked dead last by the Christians, practicing Christians, on what they thought non-believers would say. And so you have data and you have interpretation. You have evidence and then you have explanation, and those are not the same. So Barna concludes with this data, with this evidence, that non-Christians want credible, reasonable explanations, but they misinterpret, they give a wrong model, a wrong explanation, because they misunderstand the value of apologetics. And so they say, this does not necessarily mean Christians should invest heavily in traditional apologetics, however, as demonstrated by non-Christians' distaste for street preaching and tactics, depersonalized outreach that feels intrusive and manipulative, it's likely to lower openness to the gospel. Because that's a bad understanding of what apologetics is. Apologetics is not just in demand again in culture. It's always been a command in 1 Peter 3:15. Be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you for the reason, for the hope that's in you, and do it with gentleness and respect. And in that passage, we have on exhibit the head, the heart, and the hands. So much the worse for the scandal of the evangelical mind. This new third revolution is us, and it must happen now. And I tell the story of how we must show that Christianity is good for the world, not just in heaven, but now. And that it must be shown to be reasonable and true, apologetics. And I give a clarion call to pastors, parachurches, parents, grandparents, professors, philanthropists, political allies, and prayers, all hands on deck. It's the university, stupid. Even if you're not called to go back into the universities like Dr. Tor or like myself, even on the outskirts as a former professor, now running a campus ministry that's got a professor's division, student division, and so forth, you cannot hide from this stuff. You need to prepare for the ideology coming from upstream, because it's coming into your homes, it's coming into your churches, and you can't even go into the closet anymore because they have iPhones there. You can't escape the revolution. You need to prepare for it.
Because of you, millions of people have heard the gospel.
If you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he's risen from the dead, and you will be saved.
That's right.
That's the requirement.
We talk about science concepts which draw people in.
Take these nanomachines and have them drill into cells.
This would be a great way to kill cancer, right?
We also talk about Jesus Christ, who's the best in everything.
My faith in Jesus Christ means more to me than anything.
If you could continue to give or give for the first time, we would certainly appreciate it. You can go to jesusandscience.org/donate. All U.S. donations are tax deductible. Thank you so much.
I'm going to end there and talk with Dr. Tor some and take some questions from the audience.
Okay. Thank you, Corey. So let's have a discussion. So I read your book. So again, this is his book, The Progressive Miseducation of America. The church has bought a bunch of copies. There's more in the boxes underneath there. If you want to get one, you can. There's a little QR code. And then afterward, if you like, Corey can sign it for you. But I read through your book, Corey, and you really beat up on the universities, and they deserve it. They really do. But there's a lot of parents in here that spend a lot of money and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears on their children. And then you say that they care for the children for 18 years, and then you send them off to the university only to get conscripted by the opposing side. And that's what happens. And I saw some of this myself. I used to say that if you raise your children right for 18 years, they'll be fine in a secular university. I woke up my kids every morning at 5:30. We did scripture devotions. We did devotions together as a family from 5:30 to 6 every morning. I really invested in my children. Well, I don't say anymore that if you send your kids to a secular school after raising them right, they'll be fine. Because I saw what happened to two of my four children, how their worldview changed during that four-year term. I saw the impact of what a professor can do to a student. And so I became a lot more open to Christian schools. But Christian universities have another problem because there's hypocrisy, because people say that they're Christians and it's hard for them to hire faculty that really love the Lord, because think of the number of chemists that are out there that can teach chemistry that really love the Lord. The number is very small. So Christian universities, so what do you do? You want your kids to get a good education. You don't want to take them and send them into a place where it's 23-1 of those that oppose you, professors that oppose you and oppose your worldview than are in favor of your worldview. In Christian universities, you can see hypocrisy. If you really want Christians to be entering into the marketplace of the university, you want them to, they often have to go to a top-notch university, at least for their graduate school. They've got to go to a top-notch university to get a PhD. You can't get a PhD from a small Christian university and expect to get a job at a mainline university as a professor. So you've got to be able to participate in this education system and be around a research environment. What do you do? Because I feel lost after reading your book. We're stuck. How do we protect our children while giving them the powerful education that we'd like and preparing them for the next generation to go into the universities, to be Christian professors and have that voice so that 23-1 doesn't become 100-1 or 200-1 in a few years? What do you do?
Yeah. You know, the publisher told me, it sounds like you're writing a commercial for your ministry. And I kind of am. You know, who are you going to call? It's not Ghostbusters. It's Ratio Christi. And then I started to see and I started to cite a lot of cousins of our ministries in the field and thinking that all America needs to hear this. We need to prepare. This is a command. It is not a suggestion. And if you want to follow Jesus, Jesus said, love God with all your mind. He modified Deuteronomy, but he said your mind, right? In Mark, it's the parents' job as the primary educator of their children. Now, we can take advantage of youth pastors and communities and things like that. In the New Testament, the deacons emerged. It was practical. In the 1950s, 60s, campus ministries emerged. It was practical. The universities were falling. Youth pastors emerged because it was practical. You had, parents that were not believers and we wanted to be able to reach their kids as well. But we got to a point where the parents just thought, well, you know, this is nice, isn't it, honey? We can just both go get careers and get home late at night and be exhausted, but we're fine because the youth pastor is raising our kids. The youth pastors' statistics are worse than the ones I showed you about the senior pastors. Not that we shouldn't improve the pastor's game and hold them to the fire and encourage them and come alongside them, because being a pastor's hard, I've done that too. But the parents, train your child in the way they should go, and when they get older, they get conscripted to work for the other side and become Bart Ehrman. That's what we're seeing. That's a proverb. It's not an absolute, as Dr. Tor just pointed out. You've got to be able to train them in ways that I outline in the book that shows that Christianity is good for the world, because the biggest charge against us now is not just that we're false. That was yesterday. It's that we're evil, that we're wicked, that we're hateful, harmful, hideously headless, of course, but that we're oppressive. We need to be able to show that Christianity is good for the world, that it's reasonable and that it's true. This is the field of Christian thought, of Christian apologetics. You've got to be able to know where the resources are. I get it. You don't have a lot of time in your lives, maybe, to do this. But there are ministries out there that provide bite-sized chunks for whatever the need is. In our ministry, for example, we have an RC Press as well now that are booklets written by some of our top scholars in the country, from everything on the problem of science and faith, to the reliability of the Bible, to why does God allow evil, to now the cultural apologetics. And if you don't do cultural apologetics, you're trying to answer yesterday's questions. And if you don't understand cultural Marxism, you are not adequately equipped to do cultural apologetics. So we have these booklets that are 11th grade reading level, 25 pages, digital or printable, and also being translated into Spanish and into Portuguese and so forth, on race, class, sex, gender, ethnicity, and so forth. You got to do your homework. It's not going to, we can't just plug something in, into the brain in the vat and help you to assimilate that. It's going to take time. But you've got to be able to do that. If you be a missionary in India, you've got to study Hinduism. If you're going to move to Utah, you've got to study Mormonism. If you're going to send your kids off to the secular baptismal font with these kinds of statistics, and you don't prepare them, you are paying for the apostasy of your own children. Ouch. That's what's happening. There is a way. And then to Dr. Tor's point, and so much appreciate someone as stalwart as him, but who's going to come after him? We need to reclaim ground at the universities. I have a lot of naysayers. When I did ChatGPT on my book, it said your nemesis is going to be Rod Dreher, that I call Rod Dreary in the book. I love his books, but he takes more of a defeatist mentality. So I interviewed Al Mohler. I said, Al, how did you take back an entire liberal seminary? He told me. I looked at Al Plantinga in philosophy, who created a wake for Christian philosophers to approach, and now one-third maybe of those practicing in philosophy of religion are Christians, an entire discipline. And if it happened in one revolution and in two, it can happen again. So we need to encourage people to go back in and infiltrate. So our undergrad is about apologetics and evangelism, but our PhD level, our stealth programs that Dr. Tor helps us out with, and our professors' ministries, that's about integrating your faith and reason, faith and life, faith and vocation, integration and infiltration. We need to storm the beaches of Normandy. We need to send our people back in. There are going to be casualties along the way. I lost my first PhD that way and had to go on for a second. But if we do not reclaim the universities, if you do not change the university, you're just putting chlorine downstream, and it's only going to be clean for 15 seconds.
Okay, you say in your book, you point something out which I think is really exciting, is that a lot of times as people get older, they want to give back to their alma mater, they want to give back to their university, but what happens is you're pouring money into a place that teaches an ideology that is contrary to where you are. It's contrary. And the suggestion then is, if you want to do that, pour into the campus Christian groups that are on those campuses that are going to have an effect there. Pour into those groups. So I don't work for those groups, so I can make this appeal. There's a number of good campus Christian groups. You pour into those at those universities because they are coming with what's a much better mindset. So Ratio Christi is the apologetics group, and they're trying to give an answer. I share with people every week. I'm sharing one-on-one with somebody about the faith of Jesus Christ every week. I was just sharing it with a Jewish man last night. And I'll spend the first 25 minutes just kind of going over what got me here. But for the next 25 minutes, I spend on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, just stacking up fact upon fact upon fact on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the historicity of the Bible, Bible archaeology. And I get done, and I would say about 90% of the people then give their life to the Lord, about 90%. And I say, what is it that you think convinced you? They say, the evidence. I mean, you just blow them away with evidence, and it matches up with what your studies were that you showed, that people want evidence that this is true, that this can be real. And this whole area of materialism, that people have learned certain things. Many people contact me. They said, after seeing your content where you talk about origin of life, and we learned something very different in school. And now I'm coming back to the Lord as a result of hearing this. So they are looking for evidence. So that's one of the things to look at. I want to touch on another hot topic and have you answer this. So the view of LGBTQ by parents and grandparents versus the view of the same by younger people today. Younger people view their parents and grandparents as backward, intolerant, unscientific, and uneducated. But this is part of a bigger ideological difference you suggest in your book. You even relate this to Marxist ideology, and you speak of the parents moving in a progressive direction themselves just to hold their family together. Expand upon this.
So a couple of years ago, there was this radical gender onset situation that took place that it was almost like more middle school girls were transing than middle school girls existing, right? If that can be possible. Never before had we had any record of anything like that. And then it was coming through TikTok and it was coming through school and other means. But the rhetoric that is used in social media by these leftist groups are given to the kids, and they take it to the parents and they say, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, would you rather have a dead son or a living daughter? You choose. And just to hold on, suddenly the parents start to migrate into a more progressive area just to hold on to the relationship. But it's not just, it doesn't just stop there. It stops at the Bible. It stops at God's existence and things like that. We have got to be able to give an answer. We can't just say simply, the Bible said. Look, Paul did that when he went into the synagogues in Acts chapter 2 and other places. He reasoned from the scriptures to people who believed the scriptures were authoritative, that Jesus is the Messiah. But when he went to Athens and Mars Hill to the Stoic and the Epicurean philosophers, he didn't open up the Bible because they didn't believe the Bible. He began with where they're at because they believed in reason. And we have the corner of that in reason. Our foundation begins with mind and not matter. That explains why we started the universities. But also Jesus said that the purpose of life is to know God. Knowledge is not a peripheral issue in Christianity. It's central. We are a knowledge tradition, not a faith tradition. And in John's gospel, it begins sounding a lot like Genesis to pick up the Jewish audience, but he's also picking up the Gentile Greek audience. And he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and was God, and became flesh and dwelt among us. And here he is, look, anarche en ha logos. In the beginning was the logic, and the logic was with God, and was God. It is as true to say that God is love as God is logic. The ground for reason itself is on our turf. It didn't start in materialism or molecules. And it didn't start in the East, that they have a hard time explaining matter. And it wasn't started by the Muslims that came centuries later. We have an apologetic, a reason to give if we'll only get rid of the menace of mindless Christianity, the scandal of the evangelical mind, and start thinking for a change. Bertrand Russell once said, most Christians would rather die than think. In fact, they do. Ouch. So one time I had a former pastor who turned gay in my classroom charge me with creating a suicidal environment. And that's because even though I assign all and only atheist texts because I feel like I have to for my supervisors, when he brought up this issue of sexuality and says, we of course know that the Bible is not reliable right here. We know that, you know, there's a gay gene and all this. I give this biomedical argument. I'm in a secular classroom. I'm not opening the Bible. I'm on Mars Hill. And I give an alternate position, an education, not an indoctrination. And I say, all major world religions condemn or fail to condone homosexuality. The West certainly condemned. The East, according to the do no harm principle, failed to condone. Well, I don't believe in God. Okay, that's fine. The Buddhists don't either. But I said, still, all of them, it fits. But let's move on from that. Let's assume God doesn't exist. It's also not just ungodly, it's unhealthy. Unnatural, rather. What do you mean by that? Well, it's the plumbing argument. Nuts and bolts fit a certain way, right? Males and females fit a certain way. Now, many of my students are nursing students required to take my ethics class. So I prep them and say, I'm speaking to adults right now, right? So I am, I hope, right? And so I say, look, it's not just unnatural. According to Darwin, it's about the survival of the fittest. You can't survive. You can't reproduce the species through rectal intercourse. And consequent to that, it's also unhealthy. What do I mean by that? 1/3 of all homosexual males die 10 to 20 years earlier than their heterosexual counterpart. Why? Because believe the science. It's the anatomy and the physiology. It's natural law, whether God created us or we evolved. I can make that argument as an atheist because many are sitting here today and they were born a 7-pound bowling ball or an 8-pound or 9 or a 10-pound bowling ball. Sometimes there can be vaginal natural births with 10 pounds. Try to defecate 10 pounds, and I'm speaking to adults now, that brings new meaning to that crass expression, rip you a new one, because that's what happens. It rips and tears and shreds, and bad viruses and bacteria get into the immune system and destroy the person, even apart from AIDS, HIV. And then the vagina has a double membrane lining in there. It's safer. The rectal cavity has a single, and so it's more prone to puncture. And so I say this. This is not an anti-gay argument. It's a scientific argument. It's a biomedical argument. And it is used even for Christians, monogamous Christians practicing fidelity, who are thinking they're loving their partner by engaging in rectal intercourse. Now that you know what it does, to say that's a loving thing, well, love is love. Yeah, like water is water, whether it comes from the tap or the toilet, right? No, love actually means something. It means to will the good, not to emote the good, but to will the good for the other. So I go on and I show this stuff. I put this in my book. We have these answers. We can reach the Greeks and we can reach the Jews on their own turf. As the founder of modern science, Francis Bacon, said, there are the two books of God, God's word and God's work, scripture and nature, and the two don't contradict. We need to get rid of the menace of mindless Christianity. That's where it begins. We need to repent as a church.
Okay, now let me tell you, you just touched on an area and said things that there, people that are in this class that are not going to come back because they're going to say, wow, Tour is just so closed-minded and I'm not coming back. And so I just say it right out here. If you struggle with same-sex attraction or you know people that do, I certainly know people that do. And I have read about this and studied it because of the people that I love who suffer with same-sex attraction. And there's a book by a woman named Rachel Gilson called Born Again This Way. Rachel Gilson, Born Again This Way, which I think is one of the best treatments of this. She herself is a lesbian, same-sex attracted female. She is now married to a man, has several children. She has worked through this. She's in campus ministry herself. There's other good books, but that's the one that I would say to read to start, because for those of you that are struggling with same-sex attraction, that in itself is not a sin. And so I want you to understand that the position that I take on this is that there are these struggles and there are ways of working through this. Let me have you close with this before we open it up with questions. So you're going to have to answer this one pretty quickly. You write, it is dubious to think that America will become great without it becoming good, and equally dubious to think that goodness without God is enough. What do you mean?
My final chapter is MAGA and the Morning After. Can America become great again if America is not made good again? And I say no. As much as I appreciate some of the policies that have come about, and I can tell you numerous ones that have helped us win cases, even out of the Ninth Circuit Court and out of the Department of Education under Joe Biden, because of the judiciary changing under Donald Trump, we can't just go full force and make America great without it becoming good. When Tolstoy came over to America and saw and wondered why America was so great, he discerned it was because America was good. If you take away America's goodness,
Francis de Tocqueville.
And in my book, I even say there's no actual proof that he actually said that, but de Tocqueville allegedly said that. And I think he's right on. You can't have this greatness without the goodness. And this is where Christianity comes in. People are starting to like the fruit now. They're wanting to call themselves cultural Christians. That used to be a pejorative term. Now it's like cool if you're a cultural Christian. they are seeing a difference between the cultural revolution that has taken place, and they don't like it. And they're starting to see, I might want this Christian fruit, but they can't have the fruit without the root. And this is where we come in and give a cultural apologetics argument. We have got to be able to not just show this theoretically, but show it by our lives, by our Christian marriages, by our Christian families. That's the best apologetic, is the lifestyle apologetic. So that essentially is, okay, is what I'm talking about. Politics is helpful. It is not the ultimate answer.
Okay. Pascal, come up here. Take this microphone. Does somebody have a question? And it, I want you to word your question in the form of a question. All right? And that means it, the inflection goes up at the end of the sentence. And keep it short and concise. Pascal, wait a minute. We're going to get you a microphone.
Please, once more, what's the name of Rachel Gilson's book?
Born Again This Way. Rachel Gilson's book is Born Again This Way. Another question.
Thank you so much for a very enlightening talk. How do you see the unholy trinity between Islam?
Speak up.
Thank you so much for a great talk. And how do you see the unholy trinity between Islam, petrodollar, and Marxism in our universities?
I caught Islam and Marxism. What was the third one?
Petrodollar. Like Qatar is injecting billions of dollars to brainwash our kids in universities. Do you see this as a reality and how we can combat it?
Yeah, I mean,
I guess I'm still missing that third component, the dollars, petrodollars.
So you want to understand how these three systems are affecting our children?
Correct. Yes.
Yes.
We see an alliance between Islam and Marxist.
Qatar and Marxism.
Oh, Qatar. Okay, that one I just will say I'm less familiar with, but I will say there is definitely an unholy alliance taking place between Islamism and Marxism. They're not friends, but remember, the enemy of my enemy is my friends. It's the same thing with like LGBTQ. You had a Twitter war going on by many that were homosexual on Twitter saying, on X, saying, LGB, drop the T. LGB, drop the T. Just because you're in an alliance doesn't make it very comfortable. Marxism is a state-building worldview. Well, when you look at Islam and you look at what they want with the state, right, a form of strong theonomy, they're not going to get along. And that's why the big war in Chechnya was typically between communists and Muslims. But when there's someone else in the room, like a Christian, like America or whatever, they're going to create an alliance to work together to get rid of the king of the hill, as it were. And so, yes, Muslims are taking Marxist, neo-Marxist tactics on how to infiltrate systems and institutions, because that's what the neo-Marxist game plan was. That's what they discovered that was a failure with classical Marxism in being able to have a frontal assault in any country in the West. Because the West, as I describe in my book, was like a castle and a moat that when you lob shells at it, it somehow becomes like a living cell and self-regenerates. And you have to then go into the soft tissue of culture, ergo cultural Marxism, and go after the institutions, academia, media, and ecclesia, church. And that was their goal methodically for a long, long time. Okay. Muslims have learned from that. They've been trying to do the same thing. And they're working together as allies against the common enemy.
Okay, another question.
This is more of a parenting question, I guess, but we pulled our kids from the government school when they had my 7-year-old doing the transgender pledge. We said, we got to get out of here. Now they're in a private, small Christian school. But this stat, you know, 37% of American pastors have a biblical worldview. We're seeing that also at the Christian school. So my question is, along with getting them to a Bible-believing church, talking about scripture with them, what else can parents do to infiltrate the cultural Christian environment? And do you have a book or anything that you would suggest on things like that?
Yeah, the podcast that Dr. Tor and I did last night, I shared a link that will evaluate all the Christian colleges, not the high schools or elementary schools. And you'll be able to, it just answers certain questions relative to certain hot button topics. So you know ahead of time, despite what that Christian school's representation is saying, what might really be going on there. But look, again, the parents have to be the frontline defense here. And if you don't want to read and you don't have time to read a 500 page book, we have these in 25 page books. So I like Rachel Gilson. If you don't have time to read 200 pages, ours is 25 pages by a former lesbian in 11th grade reading level, right? I think that Rachel Gilson is still one of the tops in it, probably even better than our, maybe better than our author. She was from Cambridge too, right? Did Cambridge PhD. Ours is just working on the PhD.
Yeah, Yale and Cambridge.
Yeah, it's definitely solid. But if you don't have a lot of time, we have created these resources that all of these are free online. If you go onto our website and just give us your email and we'll send out monthly Ratio Christi propaganda, you'll get to access all 60 PDFs for free. If you want the one on transgenderism, it's written by someone who's got a PhD and was former trans, right? So we've got area experts on accessible, readable, small bite-sized chunks. And at the end of their booklets, they all say, here's your 500 pager if you want to read more. So you've got them digital, printable, multi-language, and so forth. You can't be trusting anybody, if you're a parent, but yourself. That's who God delegated responsibility to. The pastors, great. Youth pastors, great. Christian schools, look, I know what I'm going to get if I go to Harvard. But if I go to some of these Christian colleges, that's the danger, because you don't know what's going on there. I know a little bit more than you do because I live in this world. But you can go to that podcast and you can see the link that Dr. Tor will provide there for, to at least see that. So you've got to start somewhere. And if it's not with the 500 page books and they're out there, start with the 25 pagers.
Okay, so what he's referring to, what Corey just referred to, is he and I did a podcast yesterday for an hour and a half. We had a discussion, and listed under the in the description box of that podcast will be these references. This is also being filmed. This will also go up on my YouTube channel, Dr. James Tor. And so you'll be able to come back to this, and we will again list these resources in the description box there, or you can just go to Ratio Christi's site, which is what?
RatioChristi.org.
RatioChristi.org.
Look up our press.
And then you'll see all that's available. We're going to have to stop the questions here. Remember, there's a book table there. You can go and grab a book, use the QR code to pay for it. The church has already bought those. And so you're just reimbursing the church for that through this. And then if you want to bring the book to Corey, he will sign it for you. We have this room until 11:15. There's a service at 11. Feel free to go there. But let me just close in prayer.
Can I just say one more
yes,
thing?
Yes, go ahead.
Raise your hand if you're Ratio Christi staff in here. If you have questions, you want to talk to one of these guys, high school ministry, college ministry, PhD, professor ministry, or the press, go talk with them. Thank you.
Okay, and Zach McCray, Zach, stand up. He sings in the choir in the first service. And he's Ratio Christi's lead at Rice University. So if you want to learn about the ministry, here's the guy to go to. He's right here every Sunday, right? Okay, let's pray. Lord, I thank you so much for this time that we've had together. And Lord, I pray that you would strengthen these parents who are so concerned about their children, so concerned, and rightly so. Father, I pray that you'd give them wisdom and guidance. And Lord, protect our children, I pray. Protect these young people, I pray. And Father, I commit them to you, their hearts and their minds, in the name of Jesus. Amen. Thank you for joining me today. If you could give us a like, share, or podcast review, we would appreciate it. If you have any questions, you could send them to ask@jesusandscience.org, and we'll try to answer some of those questions in an upcoming video. And if you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you want to hear about why I believe, send me an email to tour at
drjamestour.org, and we'll get together by Zoom, and I'll share with you why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus Christ.